Saint-Saëns Cello Concerto No. 1 in A minor, played by soloist Stephen Isserlis with the London Symphony Orchestra, Michael Tilson Thomas conducting. And that brings us to the end of another edition of Sunday Morning. Thanks so much for your company. I do hope the music has gone down well. I'll be back next week with more, so do join me if you can, anytime between 9 and 12. Sunday Morning is a tandem production for BBC Radio 3, thanks to my producer, Sam Phillips, and our studio manager in London's broadcasting house, Nick Scripps.
If you're feeling confused by all the cost of living pressures, you're not the only one.
We are constantly bombarded with products. What are the facts behind the fads?
BBC Sounds has podcasts for clarity, help, or an escape.
What's your thoughts on heating the person, not the room? It's a really good solution.
From sliced bread...
I'm glad I could help a little bit.
...to understand the economy. Listen on BBC Sounds.
It's just after midday. Time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the textile designer Kay Fassett.
Kay Fassett's designs are so bright that they literally make your eyes dance. Cerise, crimson, cobalt, his stripes and flowers and paisley textiles burst onto the scene back in the 70s, and he's been designing ever since. Brought up in a log cabin on the Californian coast, he's lived for 50 years in Kilburn, northwest London, a house where every surface is painted or mosaiced or embroidered and stuffed full of antique textiles and pots. In fact, it's so full of stuff that his partner, Brandon, had to retreat to a white room of his own. But Cave would like us all to get sewing, embroidering, or knitting. He's the author of numerous books which share his designs and has an exhibition of his quilts at the Fashion and Textile Museum at the moment, which is then travelling round Scotland. Looking at those huge, bright quilts, Cave, I really felt transported away from the grey of an English winter to a colourful world.
Yes. You know, it's interesting because when English people talk about England, they say, oh, it's so overcast, we can't get away with bright colors. And I feel the opposite. I feel I love beautiful, soft, misty, overcast days. I think it brings out color.
Well, we can escape today, too, through the music you've brought, which ranges from Arvo Pärt through Carl Orff to the Beatles. Quite a romantic flavour to the whole playlist. But I think we're going to start with Erik Satie and a piece that takes you right back to childhood.
It does. It does. I wanted to be a dancer when I was very young. And this was a piece that someone choreographed and I was trying to dance to. It was very difficult for me to follow choreography. But my soul responded to the music. It was so romantic and so beautifully soothing.
And rather like your work, it's quite hypnotic, but it's simple as opposed to complex.
Yes, 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 exactly. Thank you.
Thank you.
the composer and pianist Peter Dickinson with the first of the three gymnopédies by Erik Satie. Did it transport you into a great dancer cave?
I'm afraid not. No. I physical things are not my thing. I mean, but I loved the idea of being on a stage and of being dramatic. I came from a very bohemian background of that little tiny community on the coast of California was full of artists and musicians and theater people. And so I had the encouragement to be a character. And when I went to high school, I wore bright orange cords and pink tennis shoes and Kelly Green sweaters. And everybody else was in beige and black. And that was the... occasionally you'll get a sort of dusty pink on a shirt, but that was about it for color. So I stood out as a very strange...
You were brought up in a log cabin, weren't you, initially?
I was, yes, yes. It was bought by Orson Welles, and then he ended up selling it to my father.
And it was pretty primitive.
Yes, I mean, there was no electricity when we arrived.
So, cold.
You know, it was very cold and very drafty. You know, the wind blowing up through the floorboards and so forth.
Just two or three rooms. And...
yes, and a huge fireplace, which was our only heat at that time.
And in fact, as a result of this quite bohemian lifestyle, a restaurant was started, wasn't it?
Yes, my father built a... absolute world-class restaurant designed by a Frank Lloyd Wright student. And it was very, very modern for its time back in the 40s. And I helped in the building of it, you know, and it was quite an extraordinary. But when it opened, it got fantastic publicity across the world and people came from all over the world. So we got more bohemian characters, you know, who were traveling and finding...
very famous names, actually.
Yes, yes.
Like...
yes. Well, I mean, there were, you know, a lot of Hollywood stars would come up and so forth, you know, like Gloria Swanson and people like that. You know, the Maharishi came and always somebody amazing.
And, of course, Clint Eastwood lived near there.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
What was the name of the restaurant?
Nepenthe.
Meanwhile, you conceived the ambition to be an artist, but you didn't actually love art school when you got there, did you?
No. I'm afraid, it was very formulistic. And I was kind of all right with it, you know, because they were saying draw every day. Well, I love drawing. You know, that was something that that's what got me into art school, got me the scholarship, was sitting and drawing a model very correctly in pen and ink and so forth. But when they brought out the color wheel, I knew that was the work of the devil. And I just... turned and left the school. And I said, you know, I'm not going to see the beauty and the magic of color reduced to a formula that's in a circle. So I bowed out.
Yeah, that would go totally against your work in a sense where you put the right color instinctively with an
artist. Totally instinctive. I mean, that is the absolute word for what I am. I work from the heart and just, you know, do what feels right. And it's always... done me all right so far.
But I think that's also true of music, you know. If I think of somebody like Satie, where did that music come from? It didn't come from a great tradition of that almost minimalistic style.
Yes.
And yet it was totally individual.
Yes. Yes. Very emotional. I mean, that's what I respond to in it, is that those very simple notes are leading me into a very emotional state.
It must have taken a considerable degree of self-belief to think of yourself as an artist. And I think you credit your mother with giving you that confidence.
Yes. She was a frustrated artist. You know, if she was in a different time, like the time we have now, where women are celebrated and encouraged to do more creativity, she would have been amazing. She had an instinct for the theater and for dramatic things. She was quite a large woman, and she wore very colorful clothes.
Floral smocks.
Yeah, yeah. But big scale, you know, and very strong colors and wonderful turbans and things, you know. So she had a great flair and a style. It wasn't just hit or miss or hippie in any way. It was very sort of stylish from the 40s kind of look.
That, for me, sums up absolutely the gifts of our next composer, Leonard Bernstein. Mm. It was hip, but it was very stylish. Mm. And the piece you've chosen is the famous West Side Story, the original production. And I think you saw it in Broadway in 57.
I did. And I was completely transported by that particular song, you know, There's a Place for Us, because the way it was choreographed and this lighting, it was like the dancers flew into the air and everything dissolved around them. I mean, they went into the night, into the shadows, singing this song, you know, There's a Place for Us. Where are we going to find this place for us? And since I was always such a freak in my life, you know, when I went to a very ordinary high school after, you know, the first school I started on, I was always standing out. So the idea that there was a place for creatures like myself, you know, who wanted to express ourselves, was very important.
Thank you.
Wonderful melody.
Hmm.
Carol Lawrence and Larry Kurt with Somewhere from the original Broadway cast recording of West Side Story by Leonard Bernstein. Max Goberman was conducting the New York Philharmonic. You were saying how the song really struck you at the time because it confirmed a sense of your own identity as a gay man at a difficult time. Let's remember, it wasn't automatically taken as read that one could be gay at those
Absolutely.
Times in California.
Absolutely. I mean, it was very against the law. Mm. And also looked down upon by very, society people. And I was starting to paint a great deal and mixing with the society of San Francisco and so forth. And, you know, some of those grand dames were how to very look down their nose at anything that wasn't pure, you know, heterosexual marriage material.
In 1964, you left California for London, and you've never gone back. So what was it that made you leave?
Well, I met Christopher Isherwood, who is an extraordinary character. He was much younger than I am now, but I thought he was ancient. Mm. And, I better get to know him while he still had breath in him. But he had wit and... You know, he looked at America in a very particular way.
And like Auden, like his partner.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And the comments, the sense of humor that when I finally got to England because of him, I realized that people had a sense of humor about America that I hadn't looked at our country so objectively.
I could imagine he was quite taken with you as a striking young man.
Yes, I think he was. I mean, we were at a dinner party and the whole dinner party just disappeared for both of us. We just sat and just talked avidly for hours. And then the next day, I went out to every bookstore I could find and bought every book I could lay my hands on of his and just read through his oeuvre, you know, who's wonderful. And so after reading Christopher Isherwood's books and thinking about that he came from this country called England, I really wanted to go there and find out where he was from. But also, the Beatles had just hit the scene and were coming, their music was getting known in America and they were just making their first appearance in New York. And so that also was a huge excitement to know where these people came from. You know, this wonderful mind of Christopher Isherwood and the incredible musical talent of the Beatles.
Oh yeah, I'll tell you something I think you'll understand. When I say that something, I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. Oh please, say to me, I want
That's just pure sunshine.
So that was the Beatles with I Wanna Hold Your Hand from, of course, 1963.
I remember it very, very well. I mean, amazing, coming from California, which was pre-hippie days, so it was still very... In fact, it was kind of beatnik time, so everything was black and gothic and, you know, no color. And then to hit London, where people were going around in Indian bedspreads, you know, and Dorman's, you know, uniforms with epaulettes and all of this. Wonderful, crazy, anarchic kind of delving into cultures and worlds of uniforms. I mean, you know, taking a uniform and making it kind of camp and sassy, you know, was just fabulous.
I had a military jacket and long boots, right, which I used to compare with Mark Boland to see who had the bigger heels.
Yeah.
You arrived in London, started to make a living as a painter. As I said at the beginning, your textiles are really known for their wonderfully bright colours. And yet, I was astonished to discover that when you started out as a painter, the paintings were all white.
Absolutely. I hated colour. You know, I remember I had a cauliflower sitting on my table one day because it was white, and I thought, I'll put that with my white dishes and my white cloth. But it had little pale green leaves, and so it had to go. I just took it out immediately, you know, because it was a, you know, it was against what I was trying to do. I was trying to do things that were just shades of white. And how does a form, you know, exist with shadows and highlights and so forth in that pure white world? And so it was just, you know, I was obsessed by it for quite a long time. I think the thing that got me out of the white was going to the Victoria and Albert Museum and seeing the Oriental paintings and seeing how playful patterns were and how you could use flowers with paisleys, with stripes, with zigzags, and make it beautifully harmonious but exciting, like jazz, you know, visual jazz. And so I began to introduce those into my still lives.
And you stopped painting and started knitting. Do you remember the moment when you first took up the knitting needles and started designing your wonderful coats and ponchos?
I remember it so well. It was an incredible thing. I met this very young, amazing, energetic Scottish boy who was a designer, Bill Gibb, and he turned out to be one of the great designers of his time. But at that time, he was just a student. And he said, I want to go up to Scotland and I want to discover my ancient tartans, the most beautiful old colors. And I loved that because I love history. And so I said, I want to go with you. And I went with him up on this train and we passed through this landscape of heather and lichen and beautiful, subtle, subtle colors, old ancient colors. And so when I got to the mill where they were doing the tartans, at the back of the mill, they had knitting yarns, and they were all the same colors as this beautiful landscape I'd just gone through. And I thought, the world's gone crazy. I've never seen anybody use beautiful, subtle colors in knitting. It's the harsh, horrible bits of Fair Isle that you see occasionally, or just plain colors. And so I bought 20 colors of these gorgeous, subtle colors of Shetland yarns and got on the train back to London and said to a woman sitting across from me, do you know how to knit? Because I have got to learn. I've got some urgent knitting to do. And she taught me how. It took me 20 minutes to learn. And I knitted all the way to London. And then I knitted a whole sweater in all 20 colors and took it straight to Vogue magazine, being very shy. Not. And they said, wow, this is fantastic. You know, even though it was badly made, they could see that the use of color was exciting.
Did it take a lot of effort to become technically proficient at knitting, or did you take to it quite naturally?
I took to it quite naturally. I mean, I've never been persnickety. You know, there are some people that can knit so carefully that the back of, even though if they use a lot of colors, the back of the knitting will be as tidy as the front. I've never cared. We're looking at the front, so the back can go to hell as far as I'm concerned. So I'm very loose about technique, but I've learned to tidy up my act as I go because, you know, I knit a lot. I still do a tremendous amount of knitting.
So did you feel the same kind of spirit of adventure as a knitter as you did as a painter? And do you sometimes feel that you're almost getting into a trance when you're knitting, that
Absolutely.
It becomes meditative?
Absolutely. That's exactly right. There is something about using your hands and the yarn, the fibers passing through your fingers. You know, you're using cotton, silk, wool, all of these different fibers. And and I'm using always color, because I knitted a beige sweater once and I nearly went insane. I never knew where I was. I never knew when I was finished or beginning or ending. It was just horrible. So if I knit a pattern, I go through a motif, and you get to the end of the motif before lunch, and then you go on afterwards, and you can't stop. It's very compulsive. But it's also, you're building structures of color. And so it's wonderfully expressive and creative for me.
And the other thing I've sometimes observed watching women knit, rather enviously, I must say, since I couldn't do it, is a sense of rhythm.
Yes, absolutely. Now, I do so many things. I mean, I paint fabrics and I do all sorts of things. But when I want to chill out and just put my soul back together, I just sit down in my little chair at the end of the room and I pick up my knitting and I just knit a few rows, and then I feel ready for the next challenge.
Well, we've got a piece next which has that sense of meditation. It's Arvo Pärt, his Spiegel im Spiegel, Mirror in the Mirror, for violin and piano. It's quite often on the music list guests send us, but we usually don't have time for it because it's nearly 10 minutes. And it does need time to build. But with thoughts of meditation and indeed knitting, perhaps we should go for it today. And I know you wanted this as a tribute to a friend who died last year. Who
yes, Anne James, a great producer at the BBC. And she had done wonderful documentaries about people that worked with their hands, like bell makers and jewelers and weavers and so forth. And she had a beautiful sense of poetry in her filming. So when I went to Channel 4 and proposed that I do a series on knitting, and they said, well, go and pick who you would like to film it. And I called up Anne James and I said, out of years of watching television, your films on painters are the most poetic and beautiful I've ever seen. And she said, balm to the ears. And we became very, very close friends.
Well, Daniel Hope is the violinist here, and Simon Mulligan, the pianist, in Pärt's Spiegel im Spiegel.
Thank you.
Daniel Hope, the violinist in that performance of Spiegel im Spiegel by Arvo Pärt. The pianist was Simon Mulligan. We were talking about the pleasure of knitting K-Facet. And among young people now, knitting and sewing are popular again. There's a new generation discovering old crafts, I think. That must be very pleasing.
Yes, it is, except that what I find is that the young knitters nowadays want a yarn that is lots of colors so they don't have to ever think about changing color. People are quite frightened of the complexity of working with color, and it's not complex at all, but there's this myth that it is, and so they're finding it challenging. So people do a lot of one-color knitting, and also young people seem to be very attracted to beige and very neutral kind of colors, which I do nothing for their complexions or anything. So I find it very sad in that sense.
We're going to go back to one of your early fashion shows in the 80s, and the music that was the soundtrack, it's Karl Orff. Can you tell me what we would be seeing on the catwalk as we heard this?
Well, we were into wonderful fashion shapes that were kind of exaggerated, but a sense of history always, you know, like leg of mutton sleeves from the sort of Victorian era and little peplum jackets and things like that where you could have a certain amount of pattern. But also, I love big coats, big kind of balloon-shaped coats that drew in at the bottom. And that was a big canvas to paint great big strong patterns and color on. So it was lots of big, bold designs walking down that catwalk that you could see very clearly from the audience.
And I imagine they must have been almost dancing to this music.
Yes. I mean, we've hired dancers to be our models because they moved wonderfully and they had that sense of drama. They would put on a piece and they would feel the excitement of that great shawl around their shoulders or the great coat that just dripped on the floor, you know. So it was, yeah, it was that sense of drama.
And use a climax to fling it up above their heads.
Yes. That was wonderful. You know, when the music builds and builds and builds. I remember one dancer just taking this great big shawl and just lifting it high in the air and spreading it out so that this great blast, like it's like a flag of color.
Christmas is, what dear Christmas is, Peter.
O Fortuna, the opening of Karl Orff's Carmina Burana, with Marin Alsop conducting the Bohm Symphony Orchestra and Chorus with the Highcliffe Junior Choir. Can you see them going along the catwalks?
Oh, totally. Totally. I realize, you know, listening to all this music played in a row, that there's a lot of structure, that sort of very simple structures that I'm responding to, which I like very much.
That's interesting, because I suppose some of your work looks complex, but in some ways the technique is simple.
Very, very simple. I mean, that's what I tell everybody, is that the technique of the way I knit takes up about 2 pages at the beginning of my books, and all the rest is exploration of color and pattern and romantic excitement, but it's all built on a very, very simple stocking stitch, you know.
Offsetting of a medieval poem is, of course, about the power of fate. And I guess it was fate which brought you and your partner, Brandon Mably, together, Cafe, and has become an artistic partner, too, with the textile artist Philip Jacobs. And indeed, you are the Cafe Facet Collective. So how does that work day to day, and how did you meet?
Well, I just met Brandon by chance. He was living in my neighborhood, and I got chatting to him one day at a bus stop. And, you know, he just had this kind of enthusiastic response to life. And I said, you know, if you're curious about what I do, come by my studio and just look through the window. And he came by, took one look through the window, and banged on the door and said, I want to come in and see everything that you're doing. And he responded to everything that was there. A natural artist. He just had it in him, but he had never expressed it, never been encouraged. And so I put pen in his hand, and I said, here's how you draw, and here's how you knit, and here's how you do needlepoint. And he responded to all that and learned very quickly, and then had this wonderful sense of style of bringing those crafts to life and expressing himself wonderfully. And it works very well. Philip Jacobs and myself are very painterly, and we do very detailed flowers and vegetables and leaves and things. And he has this wonderful sense of a kind of primitive graphic approach that works very well as a counterbalance to our more painterly Baroque designs.
So you sort of feed off each other.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's very, very important to have somebody around that encourages you when things are going blank, you know, because everybody loses their way as a creator, you know, and you need someone to say, that's a very good idea, keep working, keep on that.
It's rather like working with a librettist for a composer. You need somebody who pushes you in a slightly different direction from
yes,
your own.
But encourages the good things,
yeah.
You know, and says, yeah, that one you can let go. Forget that idea. It's not really a runner. But this one is, and keep it going.
How much do you, or indeed do you, use computers when you're developing textile designs?
Well, I'm one of those few people in the world who never learned to drive, does not own a mobile phone. I don't even know how to answer one. And so I, of course, don't do anything with computers. I do all of my work by hand. It's all hand-painted.
That's probably why it's so beautiful.
Thank you.
Robert Schumann next, and Scenes from Childhood. 13 short pieces, of which I think we'll be able to hear a couple. Mm. And for you, this music is what?
Well, it was the theme music of one of the most moving films that I saw years ago called My Brilliant Career. And so it just made me think of, you know, my wonderful group of creative people, Brandon and Philip and myself, you know, working together to create things. We're making a paint box for the world of crafters.
Andras Schiff performing from Robert Schumann's Scenes from Childhood. And, of course, there's something of childlike playfulness in that music, which is involved also in the making of all art, isn't there? A delight in creativity.
Absolutely. That's exactly. I mean, one of the things when I'm trying to encourage people, I say, I've never seen a boring child's painting. They're all vital and exciting and funny and, you know, unself-conscious. And that's what one is trying to do, is to come back to that childish thing of just playing and letting yourself go.
You've written many books over the years showing your designs, sharing diagrams and templates to get us all knitting or quilting. There's a real missionary zeal in all this, based probably on the delight you've just expressed.
Yes, absolutely. Because I'm a great believer that creativity is very healing.
Why have so many of these art forms been looked down on in the past? Do you think it's perhaps because a lot of them were done by women? And
yes, I think that's a great part of it, for sure. You know, the great patchwork quilts, which are now fetching tremendous amounts of money and are very sought after in America. But for a long time, it was just a very humble folk art, as you say, done by women. And so, you know, a lot of them, the great pieces that are in museums and so forth were anonymous. You know, there was nobody claiming ownership of it.
There's still an element of that, of course, despite Tom Daly's knitting. I'm sure you'd like to see more men quilt making, embroidering, because, yes, of course, it changes people's lives to be able to express themselves through something creative, doesn't it?
No, absolutely. There was a point where one of my students in my class went to work for Wormwood Scrubs Prison, and she invited me to come into the prison and talk to the prisoners, and they were amazing. And they cheered when I walked in. You know, I was like a sort of hero to them because they had all been looking at my books and things. And some of them were doing needlepoint. Only one person in the whole place dared to knit. And I said, why is that? And they said, well, there's a sort of image problem about knitting. But I said, well, why is that one guy knitting? And they said, well, he used to steal Missoni sweaters. And so he knew the value of a really expensive Italian sweater.
In fact, it was Missoni that took up your...
That's right.
When you were young. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I used to design for that great Italian family of knitters.
So do you still find time at home just to sit and knit and sew when you feel like it?
Every single day. I mean, I make that time because it's what keeps me vital. You know, when I get a bit depressed or draggy or, you know, looking at life from a weird angle, it's because I'm traveling and I wasn't able to. In fact, I take my projects on the road with me now so that I can sit in a hotel room after endless interviews or teaching people and so forth. I can sit in there and just knit my own design and let something come off the needles.
Well, we can think of you knitting away as we listen to your last music, an aria by Catalani, which became very popular when it was used on the soundtrack of the film Diva in 1981, a haunting song about travelling far from home. And was it Diva, in fact, that introduced you to it?
Yes, absolutely. Seeing that film and that very beautiful, soothing, melodic music.
Well, Kay Fassett, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. It's been a joy.
Thank you. Marina Wiggins Fernandez in that aria from Catalani's Lawali. We heard her performance from the 1981 film Diva with Vladimir Kosma conducting the London Symphony Orchestra. And that was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, Kay Fassett. The episode was produced by Elizabeth Burke. It was a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio 3. And you'll find details of today's music if you look for Private Passions on BBC Sounds, where you can also download hundreds of previous editions.
Expand your horizons with Radio 3's classical mixtape. Each day, Radio 3 brings you a 30-minute soundscape of classical favourites, mixed with jazz, folk, and music from around the world. Take time out with our specially curated classical mixtape every day. Listen at 7 p.m. on weekdays on Radio 3 or search on BBC Sounds for Classical Mixtape.
And now the news at 1 o'clock. The Business Secretary Grant Shapps has defended the government's economic approach after Liz Truss said detrimental decisions were being taken. The former Prime Minister has used an article in the Sunday Telegraph to make a detailed defence of her time in Number 10, saying she was never given a realistic chance to implement her tax-cutting plans. Ms Truss blamed what she called a powerful economic establishment. Mr Shapps said that he also wanted to see lower taxes, but inflation and debt needed to be dealt with first, and Liz Truss's approach was clearly not the right one. The government and health unions remain far apart on the eve of the biggest NHS strike so far in England. The head of Unite, which represents many ambulance workers, says the government is lying when it claims pay negotiations are going on. The government accused the union of putting lives at risk by not allowing proper strike cover to be organised. Nurses, paramedics and physiotherapists are among those staging strikes this week. Iranian state television says the country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, has pardoned a large number of prisoners linked to anti-government protests. The pardon excludes those facing charges of spying or murder. The US Navy and Coast Guard are trying to recover the debris from what the Pentagon are calling a Chinese spy balloon shot down off the coast of South Carolina. Authorities said it would allow analysts to examine the sensitive equipment it was carrying. This afternoon, it'll be dry and bright with plenty of winter sunshine for much of the UK, although high cloud may turn hazy in parts of Northern Ireland, Scotland and Northern England. It'll turn breezy in the far southwest. BBC News, it's 2 minutes past one.
Listen. It's the metal workers that capture the sound of Birmingham.
Metal City traces the story of Birmingham from the Staffordshire Horde to the Industrial Revolution and the birth of heavy metal.
Ummer, 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 clink, clink, clink.
In a documentary melding poetry, music and sound design, telling Birmingham's history.
Steel nibs dip into the dark pool with which